Hello, everybody. Welcome to Citizens Climate University, which is a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobby that provides CCL supporters with access to in-depth training, opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate policy. I'm your host, Morgan McHugh, and tonight's topic is an extended Q&A with our November speaker, Dr. Andy Hoffman, University of Michigan, featuring your questions that we did not have time for during our monthly call. So about our speaker, solving climate change and saving civilization as we know it will require a major systemic shift in our culture. Andrew Hoffman maintains that we are in a societal moment akin to a new era of enlightenment. He joins us to talk about the system-level changes to our thinking needed in the Anthropocene and the role of business in the great rethinking of our economy. Dr. Hoffman is the Holcim U.S. Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. He has published 16 books, including How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate and Reengaging with Sustainability in the Anthropocene Era, an Institutional Approach. So tonight, our agenda. First off, we're going to be getting to those questions that we did receive ahead of time that we weren't able to get through, which will be about business engagement, transportation, military, national security, cultural self-awareness, and real estate. So we're going to go ahead and get started. First off, Dr. Andy Hoffman, we were wondering, we had a few questions. Basically, can you elaborate on the critical role of business engagement on climate action with its associated opportunities?
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here and to take a second shot at addressing some of the questions. I'm in a business school, and so I have chosen the area I want to focus on, and that's try and drive business towards addressing climate change and our environmental and social issues in general. To my mind, business has to be not only part of the solution, but the solution. Business is the most powerful institution on earth. If business isn't solving these problems, quite frankly, they won't be solved. Business will design and construct the buildings we live and work in, the forms of mobility we enjoy, what transports or propels those forms of mobility, what alternatives will come in, the food we eat, the clothes we wear, it all comes from the market. So in many ways, the market is causing the climate change problem, but the market has to be the solution. If we don't steer the market to addressing this, then we're doomed. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone has to feel good about that. And some people may lament the fact that business is so powerful in our world. And that is just the state of things. But that has a place for people who lament that fact as well. I teach my students that they can divide themselves into two categories, one I call dark green, one I call bright green. Dark green sees the market as the solution. I'm sorry, bright green sees the market as the solution. Dark green sees it as the problem. Bright green sees business as an ally. Dark green sees business as the enemy. And they both have a place. One is criticizing and attacking and throwing rocks, and that's a powerful motivator for change. And the other is extending a hand and collaborating. And both of them are necessary to get this done. There's a concept that is fun to think about, the creative energy between the two. It's a concept called the radical flank effect. Developed by a sociologist named Haynes, and he was looking at the civil rights movement. And we can think about it this way, that when Martin Luther King started offering his message to the American public, it was considered too radical. White America couldn't take it. Until Malcolm X came along and pulled the radical flank way out here. And so in the climate change debate, the critics, the people who are calling out the issues, they are pulling the radical flank way out here. Naomi Klein says capitalism is the problem, pulls the radical flank way out here. Phil McKibben says let's put the fossil fuel industry out of business, pulls the flank out here. It moves the center. There's a wonderful line by Russell Train, the second minister of the EPA, when he said, thank God for the David Browers of the world. He makes the rest of us seem reasonable. And that's the radical flank in action. So I'm focusing on business. Business has to be the solution to my mind. So engaging with business is critical, I think, if we're going to deal with this issue.
Awesome. Well, great. Thank you. So how can we encourage companies to be first movers towards solving climate change? Some companies may fear that if they are the first mover, they will be financially penalized. Can you speak a little to that?
Sure. When I think about business and climate change, there are two ways that I think about it. I write about it. I teach about it. And the first is I just treat it as a market shift, just like any other. And so companies deal with market shifts all the time, and they try and respond to them, and they respond to them by innovating. And so what is the market shift that climate change represents? The challenge is to put into a language business already understands. So framing climate change as consumer demand, cost of capital, operational efficiency, regulatory compliance, these are things that companies already understand. So I put it in that language. And it works, even if they don't want to hear the message. I once gave a talk to a business group, and they were not interested really in hearing about climate change. Trade associations typically move down to the lowest common denominator. And I came in to give my talk, and before the talk began, a gentleman came in. He came into the front row, and he slammed a book on the table. And the title was facing me, and the book was called The Climate Hoax. And so I kind of knew where he was going to go with his questions. In the middle of my talk, he interrupted and he said, "This is all nonsense because climate change is a hoax." And I was able to say, "I don't care. You can be agnostic about the science of climate change and still see it as a business issue because consumers care about it, insurance companies care about it, banks, investors. I can go down the whole litany. Adapt if you wish. I really don't care." And what could he say? He was done. Now, that's sort of the beginning approach. That's sort of the gateway to get in, to get people to listen to this. The next step is to get companies to think bigger, and there's the real challenge. And so the real problems that we face are systemic problems. The solutions have to be systemic problems. So how do we change a system? How do we get companies to change a system? And that requires a broader view of time horizons, looking way beyond the next quarter, looking out 10, 15, 20 years, and thinking, in a sense, the extent to which systemic problems become their problems and what can they do to wield their power to try and drive change. And so systemic change could be what Intel has done to compel the entire electronics industry to start to focus on conflict minerals. Certainly what Elon Musk has done with transforming the auto sector on electrics when he started Tesla. Everyone said it couldn't be done. Now they're all chasing him. So those are the kind of systemic changes we need to move to. And in many cases, it's hard to do that if you say climate change is a hoax. So you need to get companies to recognize the issue and want to take broader action to compel their industry peers to come along. I've been doing some work with Paul Polman. He stepped down as CEO of Unilever, and he started something called Imagine. And the proposal is this, their theory of change is this, that if we can find sectors with a lot of market concentration, let's get the CEOs of, say, 4, 5, 8 of the most powerful companies in that sector in a room and engage what they call pre-competitive collaboration. So they've got their antitrust attorney sitting right there. But let's get them together and say, okay, let's do something on palm oil. Let's do something on climate change. Let's do something on a living wage, on human trafficking, whatever it is. Get these executives together. Get their companies to shift. Will that get others in the sector to start move with them? And that will that make it easier for governments to set policy? So the first one, make it just a standard business issue. That gets people's attention. The second one, get them to drive systemic change. And on the first one, I would add one more thing, that it's key to fit the driver to the company. So you connect it to a constituency outside the company that they care about. So for example, Procter & Gamble. If you want Procter & Gamble or any consumer goods to company to care about this issue, they're a consumer-driven company. You better get it connected to consumers. If you're at a company like Walmart, they move stuff around the country, around the world. They want to do it as cheaply as possible, connected to operational efficiency, supply chain management. I've done a lot of work with Whirlpool, and they're very proud to say, you know, we don't talk about climate change at all. We talk about energy efficiency because that's what we've been talking about for 30 years. That's what we know. That's how we address the climate change issue. That's how we're going to push it deeper. So put it in business language, you'll get people's attention.
Thank you.
With regards to fundamentally rethinking the transportation industry, how much of the responsibility do you think rests on consumers to drive demand for sustainable drive trains? And how much do you think automotive producers should drive improvements in charging infrastructure and battery technology?
They both have a place, but given what I've been talking about, I put much more emphasis on auto producers. They need to provide innovative solutions that solve these problems, and they need to market them in a way that will entice drivers in. I mean, think about the first electric cars, the first GM electric car. It was an ugly car. It had some innovations, but it wasn't really the best and brightest at General Motors putting their efforts into this. And then take a look at Tesla. It's a very sexy design. It has tremendous performance, high safety. They made it a very attractive car. And that got all the other makers to sit up and say, there's a market segment here, and they identified it. And whenever I hear car companies or any company say, you know, we're at the mercy of the consumer, I roll my eyes. I mean, if companies can sell pet rocks, they can sell anything. And so it all comes down to how much effort they want to put into really driving, you know, effective marketing campaigns, package the product well, create a good product that serves a need. And at the end of the day, again, we're talking about systemic change. And so, yes, a consumer movement can drive change. Look at what's happening in the airline sector. Flight shaming is, by some estimates, UBS did a study, and they, you know, flights increased 3-4% a year. They think that may cut that in half. So consumers can drive things. But at the end of the day, the objective is to get the products and the services out there that we need to live a more carbon-constrained lifestyle, and the responsibility of that falls on the producers, on the corporations.
So if Carbon Fee and Dividend raises the price of fossil fuels, would it then appear to violate the concept of a free market?
Well, I might begin by saying, what's a free market? Market totally free of any government regulation, any government taxing or subsidies. If you want to go there, let's take a look at how much the government subsidizes fossil fuels right now. The International Monetary Fund, most recently, I looked up the data. They estimate that globally, we subsidize fossil fuels to the tune of $5.2 trillion. That's 6.3% of global GDP. So the market isn't free already. And that doesn't include the amount of money that the federal government put into the highway system to make these cars usable. It doesn't factor in the money we've had to spend on military operations to protect oil reserves in the Middle East. It doesn't factor in the healthcare costs that are affected or created by the burning of fossil fuels. So the idea of a free market here, I think that is it's a challenging notion. The government is in many markets. The government in many ways is the market. I struggle with business students and the general public who feel that the government has no role in the market. That really doesn't make sense, because the government sets the market. The market is a set of, capitalism is a set of institutions. It's defined by the market. You can't price fix. You can't collude. They set private property rights. They enforce transaction that you have to, you know, you write checks, you put your money in the bank, how trading is done. These are all rules set by the government. And so setting the rules of the market, trying to, you know, steer the market in certain directions, they do that in many ways, whether it's FEMA with flood insurance, whether it's a tax deduction for your home mortgage, There are many ways the government step into the market, but the idea that a carbon price is going to be a disruption to what is a free market, it's not a free market now. And so the idea of stepping in to try and do a course correction, I think is totally reasonable.
Great, thank you.
What is the influence of the military in climate change as they see the effects around the world?
I think the military is a very, you know, in my remarks last time, I talked about the idea that the messenger is as important as the message. And we've become very tribal and we evaluate people's motives before we hear what they have to say. And so people need to hear it from sources that they trust. Well, the military is very trusted by many people in the country and the world. They're not taking a political stand when they look at the issue of climate change. They're looking at it from a very sober and careful view. The Navy has many facilities that are at water level, and they recognize that sea level rise is going to have a tremendous impact on those facilities. There was a group called the CMA Group, a group of retired Army generals, and they did an analysis, and they described climate change as what they called a threat multiplier. And their argument is that as climate change starts to have its increasing effects, you're going to start to have more instability around the world. You're going to have climate refugees, climate migration, and the U.S. military is going to have to step in and do something about this. Now, this isn't idle, you know, taking political sides on an ideological debate. They're looking at the reality of changes in the environment and looking at the reality of changes in how they perform their task of being a military force to protect this country. And when they say that climate change is a threat to this country, I and a lot of people sit up and take notice that that's a voice we should listen to.
What changes do you see that might have an impact on the broader public conversation on climate change and among Republicans in particular?
Well, the public debate is changing rapidly right now, right around us. Public opinion polls show that belief in climate change over the last 5 years, Yale's work of the Center for Climate Change Communication shows that we've had a 14-point jump in belief in climate change. And importantly, the partisan divide between Republicans and Democrats is narrowing. If you look at 1997, the difference between Republicans and Democrats was pretty much non-existent. And that's when the Kyoto Treaty was signed. And then the divide starts to happen where more and more Democrats think it's real, less and less Republicans think it's real. Republicans hit a low spot in 2009, 2010. Around 35% of Republicans. Since then, it's been coming steadily up. And I think it's up to around between 54 and 66%, depending on which surveys you look at. And that's important because people are going to, they vote. And the calculus for most Republican politicians is don't come out on climate change. They look at Bob Inglis and say, there's our poster child. Don't suffer the fate of Bob Inglis. He had tremendous conservative bona fides, but he came out and said climate change was real and he got voted out of office. Now, there's a certain point at which the voter base is not going to support that position. There's a certain point at which the voters will say, if a Republican comes out and says climate change is real, they're going to say, finally, we can be over this. I would posit, certainly in certain districts, even perhaps in certain states, that calculus is very near here, if not past. And what it requires is enough in numbers. It's kind of like whack-a-mole. If you have one, they can get hit. If you have a number of them come out, there's safety in numbers, and they'll start to come forward. And so that makes me optimistic that divide is starting to narrow. When you ask people, the surveys, when they ask people why do they change their mind, there's two answers. One is the physical impacts that we're seeing. And importantly, those impacts are hitting, you know, people have been able to deny climate change for three reasons. It's going to happen to somebody else, someplace else in the future. The events now are happening to this country. So they're happening to us. They're happening now. And they're happening to people we know and can relate to. And so when Harvey hits Houston or the campfires hit California or Dorian hits the East Coast, we watch that and we look and say, oh, holy smokes, that's us. That's a whole different story then another typhoon hitting a part of the world that perhaps we don't relate to. And so the physical impact is the number one reason why people are starting to believe in shifting their position on climate change. The second is they are compelled by the argumentation. And again, I go back to the messenger. One messenger that's been increasingly vocal on climate change is meteorologists, and people trust the meteorologists. And so if you looked at the coverage of Dorian, you heard a lot of meteorologists giving a lesson on, okay, what is happening here is the water is warmer, that's making the storm more severe, that's why it's whacking us, and expect more of them. And people are internalizing this. And then, interestingly, the youth movement, the climate youth movement, I think is also a big part of this. One of the problems with environmental issues in general is that there's no clear constituency. Everyone benefits from a clean environment. There's no aggrieved party. On women's issues, we have women. On labor issues, we have labor. On minority issues, we have minority. We have a clear constituency. Beyond the environment, we don't have a constituency. In fact, those whose physical or economic or political interests are harmed by environmental regulation actually make more sense as a social movement because they are a aggrieved constituency. The fossil fuel industry is a clear aggrieved constituency that climate change is bad for us, so they band together. Well, with the climate youth movement, we suddenly have an aggrieved party that's called young people, and they're talking about an issue that's important to them that's called their future. And adults listen to them, parents, aunts, uncles, grandparents, they listen to young people, and it matters. So that's really driving it. And I also think business, more and more businesses are starting to step forward. There was just a letter signed by 75 CEOs and heads of labor unions asking the federal government to step back into the Paris Accord. I mean, that's significant. When business is stepping forward saying, we need to do something, that really helps. So I think the conversation is shifting. It has many pieces to it. A component that I think is tremendously important and I want to see more of is religious institutions, religious leaders stepping forward. I think it's tremendously important that people really connect this to the deeply held values, what they hold sacred, why are they here on earth? If people hear it from the church, the mosque, the synagogue, the temple, it really has a power to motivate change. And so the Pope's encyclical was significant, Laudato Si, on care for our common home, the follow-up statements by religious leaders and other communities. There's been a little bit of a lag since then. I think a lot of religious leaders didn't actually know what to do with that, how to put that into their sermons, how to bring that into their parishes or their synagogues or their mosques. But it's starting to happen now. People are starting to step forward and say, okay, it is wrong to destroy the environment. You may not see the value of the environment per se, although many do, but if you damage the environment, you're damaging people's future. You're damaging your children's future. The Catholic Catechism describes damage to the environment as theft from future generations. I really love that connection to values that we hold dear. And I think that is a tremendous force for driving change. So I think the conversation is shifting. Even, the question of carbon neutrality is now on the table. It's on the table at my university. Many universities have stepped forward. Some companies are stepping forward. That was unheard of 5 years ago. And that is what we need to do. And it's a radical question. It's a radical commitment. And people, companies, organizations are starting to make it. That's got to get you excited that the tide is turning.
And I love what you said, that the environment does not have a constituency.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Can you talk a little bit more, though, about, I know you just touched on it a little bit, but in terms of our cultural self-awareness, in addition to being able to see ourselves capable as actually changing the climate.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the metaphor of the Enlightenment comes in that I've done in my work with Deb Jennings at the University of Alberta. We've done a number of papers and a book trying to make this connection that, prior to the Enlightenment, we looked at nature as animated by mystical forces. We didn't understand it. We were afraid of it. It subsumed us. And we understood it mostly through religion, through the Bible. We tried to make sense out of it through that. And then through the Enlightenment, Reformation, the Scientific Revolution, we started to say, well, no, we can look at the environment as a way, break it into pieces. The metaphor was the machine. It's not mystical. It has actually animating forces that we can understand through experimentation. We can break the pieces apart. We can study them. We put them back together again. And that's done great things. There's no question about it. I mean, we've been able to do many amazing things through science, but now we're starting to realize that perhaps the metaphor of quantitative over qualitative metrics, of breaking into pieces and not worrying about the whole, of the idea that nature is limitless, it's a limitless source of materials, it's a limitless sink for waste, we can have limitless economic growth, we're starting to question that. And so what is that transition going to look like? And we've proposed the idea that it would involve another shift, kind of like the Enlightenment. We've called it the Re-Enlightenment. Recognizing that Enlightenment has some political baggage, it brought about colonialism, white man's burden, some awful things, but it did bring about a shift in our view of nature. You know, Francis Bacon said we'll put nature on the rack and tease her secrets out of her. And now we're starting to say, maybe that metaphor isn't quite right. And, you know, so the shift to recognizing that climate change is real is a major shift in our values and our culture. I like to rephrase the question, do you believe in climate change, by saying, do you believe that we as a species have grown to such numbers and our technology to such power that we can alter the global climate? Because if you answer yes, that's a massive shift in our sense of our reality, huge. And it brings about sort of a tumbler of a whole other series of values that will start to fall into place. Because if you believe that, then we need a new set of global ethics. My mowing my lawn in Ann Arbor has import for people in low-lying areas of Bangladesh. Are we ready for that? I don't think so. But that's what's before us. That's the big shift. That's the Enlightenment shift that is before us. And so how we view the world, how we view our place within it, how the two are connected, it's a fundamentally different approach. And there's some really interesting writing, if you really want to dive into this, in the realm of philosophy. Bruno Latour, Mike Hume, others started to ask questions about, what does it mean? What does history mean? I mean, you know, we were at 3 billion people when I was born. We're now at 7.5 billion people. That's how rapid the change is going on. So how is culture going to keep up with that? And what Dev and I write is, what does Anthropocene society look like? And what's going to look like in 100 years? Because it took 100 years to get through the Enlightenment. It's going to take us 100 years to get through this, if we get through it. And I don't mean in a catastrophe way, but we'll constantly be battling the environment as long as we continue to grow in population and our impact upon it. But what will that world look like? How will we view ourselves? How will we see the freedom to move around the world, hop on a plane, go anywhere you want? The idea that I can have a kiwi anytime I want, is that going to stay the same way? How do we think about our responsibility to each other through the environment? These are all very interesting questions to ask of, what is at the root of this? Because to my mind, when I hear, you know, people say, you know, I bought an electric car, I put a solar cell on my roof, I'm done, problem solved. I just don't think it's that simple. It's not a simple technological fix. How are our values going to shift? How is our culture going to shift? How is our self-conception going to shift? How is our conception of the environment going to shift? That's where the real instincts and stuff starts to come in.
And going off that, as we're going through this Enlightenment, how do we encourage people to, in their lives, reduce their energy use through driving or eating or travel in a way that actually gets them to want to do it?
Yeah. I would begin by saying, you know, I think we're in the midst of the shift now, but an interesting curiosity of the comparison to the Enlightenment is that and particularly the scientific revolution, is many people didn't know what was going on when it was happening. The term was actually developed in many cases later on, and we look back and said, oh, something happened there. What was that? And it was given a name. And so a lot of people won't know what's happening until it's done. I find that very curious. But while we're in it, or while we're going through this change, if you want to encourage people to think differently, to behave differently, then you have to really connect it to who they are, in my mind. I'll have students say to me, why should I bother reducing my carbon emissions? It's not going to make a difference in the global climate. And my answer, honestly, is you're right. I mean, it's not. One individual choice is not going to change anything. But if you want to live a life of integrity, if you want to live according to your values, if you want to live the life you believe in, then you will do these things for the right reasons, because they're internal. If you do it for external reasons, they're going to be like New Year's resolutions. You're going to give it up. You're going to do it for a while, and it's going to be gone. But if you're really connected to who you are and what you believe, then you will stick with it. You'll start small, and you'll start to grow. Don't try and do it all at once. I have a good friend who's a vegetarian, and he says it in the vegetarian community. There's a shift from just being, you know, negative to anyone who eats meat at all to saying, hey, you did two nights a week. That's great. Now do three. Now do four. And keep on going. And if you live that life of integrity, you will instill respect from those who see it. You will have people that will try and mimic you. You can educate through behavior. I think that's a far more powerful motivator than just words, but words can do too. My wife teaches me all the time. She recycles very seriously. She reads labels. I used to go to the grocery store, just grab things, get in and get out as fast as I can. I now read labels. So that kind of behavior changes people around you. And then I do believe that as you start to do it, you start to see other things. You start to see the world a little differently. And then you take the next step. And if you think of people that go down this path, they're like explorers. They're like trailblazers. They're going down a path. We don't know where it's going to go. I don't know what our culture is going to look like in 100 years, but the people taking the steps now, they're going to get a better glimpse of where we're going to go. They're going to give us a better sense of what that might look like. They'll get us to try vegetarian food, and we'll learn, hey, this is really good, and I feel better afterwards. It's all about impressing others. But then I would also, I always come back to systemic change. The behaviors that I want to see people do the most are vote and start to think some of the big things in terms of your carbon footprint, transport, meat eating. These are the things that really matter. But voting, got to vote.
Again, going off that, have you seen artists or sports figures or anybody who's kind of in the limelight influence public opinion on climate change?
That's an interesting question, because, you know, people will protect something if they love it. You can give them data, maybe it'll work, but for the most part, people will be, they're motivated by their heart as much as their head, if not more than their head. And art can touch our head, or our heart, I'm sorry. And that, I think, is tremendously important and a little slow on the uptake, quite frankly. But it's happening. If you've seen the exhibit, The Anthropocene, by Bertinsky, it's powerful. It to my mind, it changed my beliefs. And it's a photo exhibit, but it's just much more. It's art. It really touches you. And there are some movies out there, Mother or First Reformed, that touch on these issues. It's interesting. And there's nonfiction out there, you know, Sixth Extinction, or there's fiction. I'm reading The Overstory right now, or there's others out there. The interesting thing, though, is they're not directly climate change. And, you know, climate change is a bit of a challenging topic to just hit in narrative form or direct artwork form. But if you can capture in literature the changing values, the conflicted values, that's what art does for us. It challenges our thinking, our values, our beliefs. And that's where I think, you know, the idea of the Anthropocene, the idea of what is that future world going to look like? What are the absurdities that we have in our present world? Art can show those to us, and they can do it through metaphor, and they can do it through allegory. And I think that's tremendously important. As far as sports figures, you know, again, the message is as important as the message. And it's impressive to me how influential sports figures can be in people's behavior. I'm dating myself, but I remember in Boston when Wade Boggs for the Boston Red Sox announced that he ate fried chicken before every game, kids all over New England started wolfing down fried chicken before a baseball game. So sports figures have influence, and there are some out there. There are a number of Olympic athletes that have made statements on climate change. But in terms of the pros, there is an interesting movement. There's the NHL has, the Players Association has a carbon neutral challenge. And they're trying to get their fans to start to reduce their carbon emissions, and they're using their referent power, their star status, to call attention to it. And I just think that's great. So everybody's got to be in this. Movie stars, politicians, radio pundits, race car drivers, I don't care. Everybody has somebody they look to and they respect. And I want them to hear it from everybody that they respect.
Agree. I think like Jane Fonda getting arrested on Fridays up on the Capitol.
Yeah. And did you see an interview with her where she said, you know, she's made a vow she will not buy another piece of clothing. Wow. Now, it's a great statement, but I would also, before I get too excited, I don't want to be crude, but, you know, how many more years does she have and how big is her closet right now? But leaving that aside for now, that's the kind of statement. I mean, will you buy less stuff? Will you consume less? These are the questions. And to take a statement on that, make stuff last. That's where this gets interesting. And, you know, people that have a mouthpiece can say it. I just heard a quote today, Doug Kelbaugh. I went to hear Doug Kelbaugh's last lecture at the University of Michigan, and he had a quote by Twyla Tharp. And those who believe in what they understand, something like those who believe in what they understand have an obligation to share it. I may have gotten that wrong, but that's the gist. And I really like that. And so if you have a mouthpiece, if you have a platform, if you understand this issue, if you believe it, say it.
Shifting the conversation a little bit, this is going to be our last prepared question. So this last question, how have you seen climate change affect real estate prices or real estate development?
Well, you don't have to look any further than California for an answer to that question. People trying to rebuild after the campfire are finding it difficult to get insurance. The state has actually had to step in, and their last resort program, I think it's called FAIR, they're having to trigger that to provide fire insurance for some homes where insurance companies saying, we're not going to touch it. Those who can't afford it are finding it is much more expensive, the coverage less thorough. And interestingly, more insurance companies, AIG is doing this, that if you have a very large home and you want them to insure it, you also have to buy into their private firefighting company. And so if you have a big mansion in California, the fire starts, the fire trucks come into your house, they're going to leave your neighbors behind, but they're going to come to your house. So that is certainly driving change in terms of development in those areas, and I think we can expect more of that. Coastal properties are going to become harder to insure, properties in floodplains. FEMA is starting to ask questions about whether we should be really putting money back into homes that have been devastated by floodplains when 100-year flood becomes a 10-year occurrence. Maybe we should move these people. So it is changing development patterns. And to my mind, it's really insurance that's going to drive that.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, thank you for answering all of the questions that we couldn't get to on the monthly call. Well, thank you so much. Thank you all for being here tonight. Special thank you to Dr. Hoffman for giving us some more time for Q&A and getting all those questions answered. If you have any questions, you can go on to CCL's community forums and feel free to ask it there.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.